This week's after-dinner speaker is our transitional engineer, as in making the transition to a carbon-free economy, Susan Krumdiek from Canterbury University. I spoke with her about an hour ago because right now she's presenting an online lecture to about 2,000 students at the University of Pune in India. And that's what Susan wanted to focus on, initially at least, some of the fossil fuel solutions some of her Canterbury University students are coming up with. I'll let her pick up the story.
Transition engineering, the theory goes, is a transdisciplinary field that's emerging amongst all professions in engineering and with other professions in order to simply do the projects of reducing carbon. Now, to do that, you have to use a methodology that lets you get into that creative space because, man, the way the world is going, the amount of carbon we emit, the lack of choices that we have, if we care, you just feel stuck. You don't know what to do. It's hard to be creative. So I taught 40 of our best mechanical engineering students down here at Canterbury, and they came up with some really amazing ideas and projects that they could just go to work doing. And so I thought it might be fun if we talked about some of those and how possibly if we took those 40 stories together with the ones that my post-grad students have done and that I've done with other companies and councils, we could actually build up a whole mosaic of around the regions of New Zealand what that transition looks like. Does that sound fun?
Yeah. Susan, when you set that task for your students and you talk about methodology, what are the parameters you put around how they respond to the challenge?
Well, we start off the class actually making sure that they understand the science behind climate change and resource depletion and water issues and food issues and soil degradation, etc. And they're not that enthused about that. It's kind of depressing. And then we talk about all the different energy sources and how they work and how profitable each one is. And then they get a little depressed about that because a lot of the things we like to talk about, wind and solar, are very low profitability energy. By profit, I mean the energy they return to the economy for the cost and the energy that the economy has to invest in it isn't great. And so you can't just substitute them for the fossil fuels. So then we get to the point where it's clear that reduction of fossil fuels, dramatic reduction of fossil fuels, is the project. And then they go, okay, that sounds impossible. And then I teach them the transition engineering methodology. And we did some workshopping and a field trip where we did brainstorming. And I'm so excited about what they did because if you look at students, you'll have a bell curve of capability, right? And usually your top students do a good job of what you set them to do. And then the others, okay. And then there's kind of a tail that it just wasn't very good. But these guys, like all the students, jumped into how the heck are they going to have a future? I mean, this is real for them, these meeting of these targets. It's not an abstract idea. They're going to be there, you know? And they were able to find those creative spaces and follow the methodology and come up with some great ideas for projects.
See, Susan, when we spoke last, you made the point, and I'm pretty sure actually this has been a theme in our discussions since you came on tonight, which is don't just think that we can replace one source of energy for another. We can get rid of the fossil fuel energy and find another one, and then everything carries on as before. That has not been your message. Your message has been we have to use less energy if we are to survive. So when that challenge is thrown at students, it means we just don't find some kind of, I don't know, a way of making all the consumer goods that we currently enjoy, but using something that doesn't use fossil fuel, or a cruise ship that doesn't use fossil fuel. It's a little bit more subtle than that, right?
That's correct. Well, I teach them how to do energy economics accounting, and then they can tell for themselves. So it's not about what I say. It's about what the actual physics and the numbers show. So teaching them how to do it, that's the trick.
What are some of the things they've come up with?
A lot of people are interested in flying, for example, right? What are we going to do about flying? And some of the students were very excited about the stories that you can find online about electric planes and hydrogen for planes and things like that. And then once they did the energy economics of that, they were disappointed that that wasn't going to work. But I said, okay, stick with flying, though, because this is a big question. What the heck are we going to do about flying? So here's an example of a engineering project with Air New Zealand. Right? So Air New Zealand, we want you to get in here and do a project with us where we sit down with you and Airways to look at the flight schedules that you've got. And we're going to figure out how to reduce the number of flights by 10% a year, because that is actually the requirement for meeting the COP21 emissions targets. And you've already got air traffic control systems, and you've already got the airline, like how people find flights. Essentially, you need to do the work of doing the engineering of how to move the profit margins, how to balance all the books while reducing the number of flights. So you got to choose which flights to reduce, et cetera, et cetera. And then you got to start rewarding people for not flying instead of rewarding them for flying a lot. And so you just sort of flip over your business model, but figure out what the costs are to be profitable while you're reducing the number of flights. And you know what? If you start to work on that, you see that they've overshot. They're offering too many flights at too low a price. They've stretched themselves too thin. They're not really that profitable. And so getting back into profitability by pulling the whole operation of the industry back to where it is profitable, which is with quite a bit less flying, is just sort of like an obvious thing to do. What do you think of that one?
Well, I'm thinking people who are in the tourism sector might feel a chill right now listening to that. So, you know, then maybe does any student come up with, say, an innovation or an engineering solution that might allow us to enjoy some of the things that we currently enjoy by traveling to other countries?
Traveling to other countries is a funny thing because I remember my PhD student when I first came here 20 years ago was talking to me about his mom's big OE. And she apparently enjoyed it a lot. And she did it by a ship. And on the ship, I guess it was kind of like cruise ships, but not like cruise ships. You could, you know, you didn't have to sit in one place all the time like you do for 14 hours in a long-haul flight. You could walk around, you could read, you could, you know, go out on the deck. And it took about 2 weeks to get to the UK on this passenger ship. And she really enjoyed it. And I think that what we think we're entitled to, what we expect to have, is relative to what we're used to having. And that if a big OE once in our lifetime is what we can have and not cook the planet for our kids and grandkids, we will enjoy it a lot and it'll be fine.
What about keeping a city warm? You live in Christchurch. Now, it might be getting warmer, but even if it is, you're still going to have cold winters in Christchurch. And you got 300,000, 400,000 people. And at the moment, okay, in New Zealand, we're lucky enough to have hydropower, but a lot of people still, you know, need heating, and that heating might still need something that comes from fossil fuels. Anyone engineering something which allows us to keep ourselves warm enough, whether it's insulation in houses or the energy source?
Now, that one's funny because I did show them my house and how I redesigned and rebuilt it. And right now, it's getting pretty cold outside, and I wouldn't know that sitting in my house because my house is warm. I use wood pellets with radiators throughout, so it's water-circulated heat. And yes, the walls are insulated to about twice the current standard, and there's UPVC thermal windows. And so it's a house that for hundreds of years in the future will serve whoever's here using stored solar energy in the form of wood pellets. That's the way to go. That's not the question. The question is, how do we change what we've got to this long-term way of doing things? Because you can't stay warm in an uninsulated house, no matter how much electricity you burn through. People like a wood fire because you can get a really high temperature, so when you sit next to it, you feel comfortable, but that's not good for the rest of our lungs. The wood pellet fires burn pretty much absolutely cleanly. So what we would go to isn't the question. It's how would we get there? What does that project look like, rebuilding all these homes? And that question is about training. It's about the way the businesses work. It's about the way financing works. And so one of the solutions there is a building cooperative as a type of state-owned enterprise that includes the training with the polytechnics and sourcing of materials on a mass scale, so that we've really got to cut the cost of building down by more than half in order to be able to do this. But that is actually possible. So anybody who's built anything recently knows what I'm talking about.
Another thing that you mentioned earlier, as in previous chats with me, was, and it might have been the second or even the first one, I think it was the second one, and you talked about, because it was at the start of the pandemic, this might be the pandemic that saves us from ourselves, because it reduces, we are forced to slow down, and we've been burning around the world because of lockdowns, we've been burning less fossil fuel. But now, of course, in New Zealand, we are at this point in time, because we're lucky, and if our luck doesn't run out, we are able to live a reasonably normal life again. But we've got all these projects that are designed to stimulate the economy and also provide something useful, those shovel-ready products. I don't know about you, Susan, but I notice a lot of them seem to involve shovels, building roads and other stuff like that.
Well, that's because that's what we've been having in the planning pipeline for the last 50 years. And so if you're going to go shovel ready, then that's what you've actually got, because that's the way you see the world, is that you got to build more roads. I would love to have a set aside for future ready projects. I mean, okay, a lot of the projects that were funded are also maintenance that we got behind on, so stuff that we should have been doing already. So that's
sewage.
Do your maintenance.
Like sewage,
yeah. Plants. Yeah, getting those back up to snuff. Our schools, there's a lot of stuff that maintaining them is good. But yeah, no more roads, zero tolerance on roads. What we do need to do is the future ready project for transport is electric rail and electric trams.
I don't know about you, but I've noticed, because coming out of the pandemic and we're able to travel again, I was trying to organize a few trips. There's a family trip I've got to do next month, and then there's the summer holidays, and it's actually got harder since the lockdown to find an alternative to flying. Buses are now, when I go and look and try and book online, I can get a cheaper flight to Auckland from Wellington and back again than I can a bus trip at the moment. And the rail system, the train system isn't up and running yet in the North Island, long distance rail. It's going to be later on, but it's not yet.
Right. The priority going on to that electric rail system that reaches not just the main centers, but the hinterland, you know, that goes to our small towns. You know, if you can possibly do the thing that is step four in the transition engineering methodology, which is to move your frame of reference 100 years into the future, you'll see that the era of the diesel-powered truck, the era of the personal transport using your own private vehicle is well and truly over, and people are going to visit their family by going down to the station in their town or their city, getting onto the train and enjoying their train ride, looking at the scenery, you know, visiting with people and then getting off. It's just... That is the future.
So it does sound a little bit like the past, though, Susan. And here I'm being a devil's advocate, but that does sound like a little bit like New Zealand in the 50s and 60s. But one other thing I tried to do, and that was...
The rails would be much quieter, though, and more comfortable.
The one thing I also tried to do was to book a electric rental car. And I couldn't find any outside the main centres. Even Wellington, it was a struggle to find one. And if I did find one, it was really expensive. The option to even just go for an electric car, private car, rental car, isn't really there yet?
Well, that's an awful lot of resources for that requirement, I guess. Like I said, the individual private vehicle requiring about as much carbon to manufacture as one of your long haul flights. It's just, I know it's tempting to think about the way things are that you experience them right now, but when we're talking about billions of dollars of investment, that has to be done with a very big picture and a very long term. I'm sorry you can't rent an electric vehicle.
Yeah.
Right now.
What you're saying, Susan, is that replacing all our petrol and diesel cars with electric cars isn't a solution in your book.
No, that's one of the things that depressed the students a lot. They had to sit down and build a model of the carbon emissions due to driving of different types of vehicles, due to the manufacturing of different types of vehicles, and run that through different scenarios. And essentially, the almost 20% growth per year of electric vehicles does essentially bugger all to reduce our emissions. Why? Because you have to make those vehicles. And making the vehicle is just really carbon intensive, and you can't get away from that. You don't actually reduce carbon by buying and driving an electric vehicle. You do not reduce carbon because you're responsible for all the carbon that went into it. So if we're going to own our carbon, we're going to build stuff that's going to take fossil fuel. It's going to require concrete and steel. Then we build something that lasts for hundreds of years, like an electric rail system, not a car that lasts for 8 or 9 years. Yeah, and that everybody can use, not something one person can use. I know things have been a certain way for the last 50 years, and I know that it puts you off a bit to think, oh, that would be kind of like what they did in the 50s. But if we hadn't had this sort of weird party around oil for the last 50 years, we would not be sitting here staring down the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, the calving off of the glaciers. We would not be in this emergency. It would be farther down the track.
Susan, thank you very much for joining us again.
You are absolutely welcome.
Susan Crumdiek from Canterbury University, back with more on engineering our way out of fossil fuel dependency in about 10 weeks.